The following podcast is offered freely through the Insight and Meditation Community of Washington and by Jonathan Faust. To learn more or to make a donation to support this work, please go to www.jonathanfaust.com.
So maybe you noticed that little Jedi mind trick I threw in there. As I breathe in, I'm aware I'm breathing out. That was kind of amusing to hear come out of my mouth. I suppose in some non-dual state of consciousness, it's utterly possible to be aware as you breathe in, you're breathing out. Something's breathing out, maybe. So one option to wake up is seclusion. You withdraw from the world and you distill your experience as it arises. When greed arises, you purify that through paying attention to it, investigating it, releasing it. When hatred arises, you process that. When delusion arises, you investigate that as well. And withdrawing from the world is a bona fide approach to spiritual evolution, if you will. And in many ways, by coming here to sit in silence for this half hour, coming here for this evening, that's a withdrawal from the world. You step back from all of the input and you collect yourself. There's another way of working your stuff and waking up, which is engaging in the world, where you actually use the events that show up in your life as the guru, as the teacher. You invite everything as part of your spiritual practice. So your work is a spiritual practice. Your relationship is a spiritual practice. And what life delivers you, you accept as, this is my teacher coming to me. The shadow side of the withdrawal apart, of the withdrawal part of that, is too much introversion. You get stuck in your own story and you can't get out. You need some external stimulation, some echo chamber to sense who you are. And the shadow side of engaging fully into the world is too much extroversion. You get lost in the stimulation. Or you become overstimulated. You don't even know what you're reacting to. And you need to step back and disengage. So finding that balance is part of life. Learning when to pull back, learning when to engage, when either of those is actually healthy and optimal. At some state they're too much, others they're too little. So I offer all of this as kind of a context for the talk tonight, which is a little bit different than other talks. I'll tell you a little bit more about it, but there's been a real discussion in the Dharma community around what does it mean to be mindful in the context of the social violence and the racism that's now so up right now. How do we be mindful in these times with a premeditated act in a historical church? In the court, the families, you know, spoke to forgiveness, which was extraordinary. I think that act has somehow pulled the best part of ourselves more open to the conversation as a culture. And now the issue of the flag, you know, 150 years later or whatever, there's a deeper understanding of its symbolism and the impact that it has on a particular segment of our population. So there's been a call in the Buddhist world to speak to how do we heal the societal issues. Over 1,000 Dharma teachers signed a letter of intent as to how to act on that. So it's not a really easy talk to give. Other Dharma teachers have given this talk and people have walked out. Because some feel that a Dharma class should be more about finding respite from the world, not to bring up the, you know, the difficult issues at different times. I think there's a middle way where we're really looking at what I find interesting is pragmatic Dharma. How do we take these teachings and actually apply them in ways where we can see whether they work or not, you know, test out those theories. So as someone who's kind of conflict avoidant, I'm somewhat self-conscious about the topic. And there are some really beautiful Dharma talks out there. Tara has done one. Ruth King, who does a lot of teaching out there, their talks are extraordinary. So I really invite you to check them out. So what I'm going to share is some personal observations, and we'll have a meditation in there as well, which I think might be helpful for you, I hope. And so there are four things that I'd like to explore, and one of them is how each of us in our own way wakes up to the reality of ignorance and delusion. And that is part of like the awakening of who we are as human beings, to see it and experience it. And to talk about the nature of delusion. Delusion is considered one of the three poisons, the three mind states that makes it impossible to be present and fully awake. And to talk a little bit about what it takes to overcome delusion in your own practice and how we'll do it as a community. And then to talk a little bit about what does it mean to be awake and practicing in your life with an open heart in the middle of chaos, in the middle of upheaval. So at some point in our life, we find out it's not a perfect world. And as I've reflected on my own sensitivity around diversity and so forth, while my parents were very liberal and progressive Quakers, I grew up on a farm in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, you know, back on a dirt road, and went to public school for quite a few years. And so most of my neighbor friends were farm kids, and some kids' fathers worked in factories. And in kindergarten, we had a number of kids who didn't speak English. And it wasn't that they spoke Spanish or some other external language, they spoke German. They only spoke German at home, because they were from the Amish or the Mennonite families. So where I grew up, the class was full of Dietrichs and Fenstermachers and Glockners and Buchners and Brubachers, and a very Germanic area. And with the last name Faust, I fit right in there. And it was in sixth grade, there was a migrant worker family came through, and their son, who was an African-American kid, came to class and was introduced to our class one day. And I remember it very clearly because there was such innocence among our little group of 27 kids in my class that there was just a curiosity. And I remember it being like this really kind of a cool sort of welcoming, who are you, and playing out in the field and so forth. And there was something so sweet about it. You know, it seemed like none of us had yet been tainted by any kind of inclinations. We hadn't been touched. In some ways, because maybe it was so insular. In ninth grade, I went off to a Quaker boarding school. And that was provided by my wonderful grandfather, another German, whose name was Wilhelm Frank Kaiser. And I became very good friends with a guy named Gil Hines in ninth grade. And so we decided to become roommates for 10th grade. And Gil was from South Philly, and the family was originally from South Carolina. And we became just the best of friends, you know, just such a natural ease. And he just had a great sense of humor, so we got so we could do each other's accents perfectly. So I'd walk into our room, and I'd say, "Damn, man, what you stuff doing on my bed?" And he'd go, "Well, gosh, let me clean it up." And so we enjoyed switching that back and forth. So I invited him to come back for a weekend to my family farm, and we hung out, and we went into town. And Gil had gone into a store, and so I saw an old classmate of mine. And, you know, I hadn't seen him in a year or so. So we were just chatting, and Gil came out of the store and came over to us, and, you know, with a big smile on his face, and I started to introduce him to my friend, this public school guy, and he turned and he walked away. And I was so struck by that experience, you know, and to see like the narrowing of his eyes and the, just this hatred come up and the fact he just turned and walked away from both of us. I was embarrassed and I was hurt and mostly just stunned because I'd never seen anything like that before. And Gil, to his credit, you know, shrugged it off and, you know, we went on from there. But perhaps you remember a time when you first saw just blind prejudice. It's kind of a searing experience to the heart. For some of us, it's sort of sudden and clear. For others, it's just such a part of the air we breathe. We don't see it. We're inculcated into it. It's easy to fall asleep into that. So being mindful means being aware of really two realms. It's training yourself to be aware of what's happening as it's happening. But it's also training yourself to be aware of how you're experiencing or holding what's happening. And even in any given moment, that is our practice. What exactly is happening right now? Can I bring non-judging awareness to this moment? And then how am I holding that? Can I hold that with equanimity? Where am I pushing away? Where am I grasping? So that experience was a very important part of my education about the world. I got to see hatred. And I really got as well that hatred was based on ignorance, because I knew that if these two guys really knew each other, they'd be friends. I mean, I knew that because I knew them both. But he had no interest. My friend was his enemy, and therefore so was I. So the Quaker school I went to was very into diversity, and we had a very diverse class, and it became a very powerful experience for me to move from a farm community into a kind of a little international hub. And later, after high school, a good friend and I did a road trip, and we drove down to Hartsville, South Carolina to visit Gil in his family home. His grandfather had a funeral parlor in Hartsville. And again, we were so, we just had so much fun. And Gil got to borrow the van that they used at the funeral parlor, affectionately known as the meat wagon. And so I remember driving around town and realizing people were looking really, really strangely at us in that part of town. And we actually did go to a drive-in, and my friend Randy lay down in the back under the canvas, so we snuck him in. That was that was fun. But when we see ignorance, or when we experience ourselves as ignorant, that is a sign of the first and second noble truth, that suffering is part of the human experience, and that there's a cause. And the cause of suffering has to do with some form of attachment or clinging or identification. And one cause is ignorance. How many churches have been burned in these recent weeks? Some were clearly not arson, but some were. And the mentality of someone who would strike out so violently, you know, wanting to do harm. And what this brings up for me in my own practice is an investigation into anger. And how would anger drive someone to such an extreme? And one sign of anger is the inability to empathize, the incapacity to sense another's experience. You lose your capacity to even imagine what the other person's thinking or feeling. So when the killer said, "You rape our women and you're taking over the country," he was living in delusion of an unreal other. And he remarked later, I believe, that he hesitated because everyone was so nice to him. But he felt it was his mission to do that. So there are three poisons to remember in the Dharma. Three energies, three mental states that when they are present, you are utterly, utterly unable to be fully present. One of them is hatred. One of them is greed. And one of them is delusion. And delusion is basically believing something is true that is not true. Or believing something isn't true that actually is true. And when we engage into spiritual practice, into spiritual inquiry, we're consciously turning our attention to be more and more aware of how we're influenced and governed by those three energies or those three winds. You become more aware when you are caught in wanting and yearning and craving. You become more aware when you're caught in judgment or blame or ill will. And you begin to become more aware of when you're not aware. You begin to become more aware of what you don't know. So greed is a desire for more, to keep what you have, the fear of it being taken away. And hatred has some aversion to the unfamiliar, a fear of losing control, losing what makes you comfortable, or losing love. And delusion has that quality of believing something to be true when it is truly not, and clinging to a belief that's inherently false. So in the face of the three poisons, there is a remedy, and the remedy is truth. What's actually true? And that's why I just have so much admiration for those who have the courage to really practice, because you come in contact with reality. You see that everything is changing. How you're holding it determines your degree of suffering. And you begin to sense this, who you are as the observer. So truth is perennial truth. You know, what was true 1,000 years ago, what will be true 1,000 years from now. And that's what this path is all about. So as I was doing some research on this, I read an interview with Chris Rock, who was, wow, what a great brain he has. And he was talking about how inherently positive he feels about this. And I thought it was interesting in the perspective of really looking at truth. The person asking him this question in the interview said that the increments of change in this whole issue seem to be much tinier than they were back in the Civil Rights Act. And Chris said, he said, yeah, but the stuff you're talking about is in pockets, though. There are always going to be people that don't know the war is over. I'm more optimistic than you. But maybe it's because of the way I live that I do. I have a great life, so it's easier for me to say that things are great. But not even me. My brothers drive trucks and stock shelves. They live in a much better world than my father did. My mother tells me stories of growing up in Andrews, South Carolina, and the black people had to go to the vet to get their teeth pulled out. And you still had to go to the back door because if the white people knew the vet had used his instruments on black people, they wouldn't take their pets to the vet. This is not some person I read about. This is my mother. When I went through some diversity training through Spirit Rock, through a community Dharma leadership training, we formed small groups and we shared about our own individual experience of exclusion, what it felt like to be excluded. And one woman, a beautiful woman from Southeast Asia, she spoke about how what a happy, happy childhood she had. And then one day she overheard a cousin, an older cousin who she totally admired, who was talking in the other room about dating and getting married. And she said, I'm just so glad I'm not as dark as, and she named this woman, because it's going to be so much easier for me. And she said it was the first time that she was sort of struck with horror that she was different. And there was something not so good about her because of her skin color. As I heard more and more stories and began to develop my own capacity to really empathize, to try to imagine what it must be like for another, for me it's deeply, deeply humbling. The self-consciousness, the shame that gets driven into those of us who don't feel like we belong. And of course, the self-consciousness is not just personal, it's an institution. It's in the air we breathe, in the advertising, in the news, the way that we speak about events. We create others who are not real, and then we reinforce those stories. So the first noble truth is that suffering happens. The second one is there's a cause. The cause has to do with attachment, with identification, with clinging. And the third is about the cessation of suffering, that it's possible to free ourselves from suffering. And the fourth is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering, the practices, the observances, the techniques, the ways that support you in becoming more free. So last week, I was teaching in New England, in the Berkshires, which is the far, far western edge of Massachusetts. And on a sort of an afternoon evening I had off in this training, I was driving up to North County, up toward just toward the Vermont border to Williamstown, to see some friends I hadn't seen for years who were selling their house. And I had to drive through a small city called Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which is what had been the home of GE, had been a real vibrant community, and then GE left, and it was just a shell. And still good activity and still good people and so forth, but not the city it was. And it became renowned as sort of a part of the drug avenue from New York City up to Montreal. It was there for the first time that I actually saw crack houses when I was delivering some stuff to a church, some volunteer stuff to a church. And I actually saw the kind of the burned out houses and people stumbling around, and I couldn't believe that existed, but to see it. So I was driving through town, and I went through a little side street to kind of, as you were sort of directed through. So maybe going 20 miles an hour, and it was a nice day, and the windows down. And I was just driving along, and there were a bunch of African-American kids, probably high school, maybe a little bit older, who were kind of clowning around. And as I was driving by, I could feel myself tighten. And I got to watch my self-observation kind of kicked in, because I found myself sort of tightened and be be a little bit fearful, and that I sort of watched and judged myself for feeling that way, and that I went to this whole kind of reverberation of, well, is this really true that I'm in danger, or is this just a thought? And it was a very interesting experience to see it kind of slow down, how in that moment I had an energetic reaction. Was I being unduly prejudiced, or was I being pragmatic? I don't know if I was being foolish or if I was being practical. And I'll never know, but I do feel, after that event, just kind of overwhelming empathy for these guys, who most probably were just clowning around on a beautiful summer evening without any idea of my own spinning wheels. I feel huge empathy for the filter they have to operate through in this life. So the practice is to be aware of what's happening and to be aware of how you're holding it. So then the question becomes, how do we go about healing our own personal delusion? How do we do that? And I think perhaps one of the most direct paths is the cultivation of empathy. For me, I've gotten so much out of this as a conscious practice. It's simply the capacity to role reverse. The capacity to imagine what it's like for another person. It can be instant healing. About maybe 3 months ago, I was asked to officiate a wedding in D.C. And it was with good friends. I was happy to do it. And the event was in a park in D.C. It was kind of a mixed area. And I always get a little bit freaked out driving in the city. So I had my GPS, and it was in sort of a neighborhood. It looked like one of those neighborhoods that was slowly being yuppified. And I couldn't exactly see where the park was, but I could see it on my GPS. So I pulled into a side street and parked in front of someone's kind of row house and found my place and was really disoriented. And so there was an African-American guy across the street. And I went up and I asked him, I said, do you know where the park is? Where we're going to be having this, the wedding. And I could tell it how he looked at me, that he was angry. And he said, there is no park around here. He said, maybe it's somewhere over there. And my reaction surprised me because it was so quick. And maybe it was an hallucination, but I feel like I got it. There I was, this white guy in a coat and tie parking in his neighborhood, which was probably being gentrified all around him, intruding on his space. And I was the unreal other to him. And I saw why he had a reason to be angry. And I feel so fortunate in that, because I felt it just went right through me. I didn't feel anything sticky about it. I just a sense of some empathy and maybe a little sorrow. So the intention to wake up in the internal world or navigating the external world has been described as swimming upstream. You're swimming against your own conditioning. And more than that, the Buddha said, you're swimming against the entire culture. And this society is not designed to slow down. It's there to reinforce the drugs you can take if you're feeling bad and the stuff to buy that'll make you feel good. But I really do find that there's the possibility of waking up. The churches that have been burned down, there has been an unprecedented amount of money raised throughout our whole society to rebuild those churches. It has brought people together. Back to this interview with Chris Rock, which I highly recommend. I'll send you the link. He said, the question is, you know, my kids are smart, educated, beautiful, polite children. There have been smart, educated, beautiful, polite black children for hundreds of years. The advantage that my children have is that my children are encountering the nicest white people that America has ever produced. Let's hope America keeps producing nicer white people. Then he was asked, I love this, it's about white people adjusting to a new reality? He said, owning their actions. Not even their actions, the actions of your dad. Yeah, it's unfair that you can get judged by something you didn't do, but it's also unfair that you can inherit money that you didn't work for. So the question is, how do we heal individually in our own life, in our own practice? How do we heal as a culture? And how do we find ways to interact? Helen Schuckman has a beautiful quote that says, your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. I love that line. It's a way, truly a way to reframe your life. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. And of course, when we pay attention with interest, without judgment, we are treated to that. We get to see that, the barriers that we have built. So much about healing is our attention to what is not healed, our capacity to be with the stress and suffering of ourselves and others. But it's also about cultivating the connections that we have. It's another short piece from Katie Whelan, and it's called What Can't Be Measured. For 2 years, April Lee Uzarski bought coffee from Lena's cart on the east side of Manhattan. Lena sang happy birthday to Ms. Uzarski in February. When Ms. Uzarski's husband had an aneurysm last year, Lena offered her coffee and support every day. From her cart on East 52nd Street and Lexington Avenue, Lena knew more things about Ms. Uzarski than some of Ms. Uzarski's closest friends. You, Lena Mizorski, are a good friend, wife, and person. Three things Ms. Uzarski often doubted about herself. But in April, Ms. Uzarski was offered a new job. It would mean not seeing Lena every day. The decision weighed heavily on Ms. Uzarski. She took the job, but before she left, she wrote a thank you note to Lena in the New York Times. Here is one line from it. The value of the kindness you have shown me in the past 2 years is immeasurable. In this city where wealth, happiness levels, and air quality are measured, there are still things that are immeasurable. And they can happen on the corner of 52nd and Lexington. Lena took a point in time, probably no more than a handful of minutes every day, and made something with it. She reminded Ms. Uzarski that she mattered. There are no special tools needed. Lena wasn't delivering babies or cracking codes. She was serving coffee. Any one of us can do it. Because the truth, as Barbara Kingsolver describes it, is this. Every day is different because you passed this way and touched history. Why not make those lives different in ways that matter? Add humanity to our transactions. Flood common moments with uncommon kindness. It's in each of us to touch history immeasurably. It doesn't take more than a cup of coffee. So I thought we might do a little reflection on some of this. If you like, you can close your eyes. And you might bring into mind someone in your life who's going through a hard time right now. Someone who might be under some stress or suffering. And you might, in your own way, just draw them into your consciousness, into your heart. And in your own way, you might just freely wish them well. May you feel happy. May you feel peace. May you feel safe from inner and outer harm. May you feel free. And is there a sense with this person, something you might do as a gesture of compassion, a note or a phone call, or maybe just simply to hold them in your heart? And you might, over the next minute or two, just bring into mind others in your life who seem like they're going through a hard time. And in your own way, let them know that you're aware of this, and in your own way, wish them well. And you might, in your own time, let your breath deepen, and if you like, you can let the eyes open. One of the things I noticed growing up in the Quaker meeting during the Vietnam War was how many angry pacifists there were. Rageful pacifists. Not that their intentions weren't absolutely honorable, but there is something about looking externally and judging without doing a really clear assessment of what we can heal in our own inner circle. And those who we might touch who are on the periphery, who we hadn't touched or noticed before. And so there's a call to action that the Dharma community has put out. There are four things to consider about becoming more awake and aware about how we can better relate to each other. One of them is to commit to ongoing self-education, to not fall into the trance of how we hold each other. Another is to engage in facilitated group work. There's some amazing groups and processes that can be very helpful for bringing more wakefulness to this issue. In the Dharma community, there's an intention to promote more structural change. Many in the Dharma community offer the teachings freely, so they're available to all, so that no one will be ever turned away. And as well, there's more of an intention to bring classes to the areas that are underserved, you know, in the prisons and schools, but also into underprivileged communities. And with that, a very strong intention to support people from the communities who want to teach, which is very exciting. And the third is to build collaborative relationships with people of color. And so it's very interesting to see the work that is being done, the amazing work of bringing the Dharma into the prisons and to underserved communities. And it's very easy to become overwhelmed, to sort of hit the compassion fatigue with everything that's going on. And it's easy to fall into inaction as well. So the real question is about what each of us can do personally to be more awake of the separation. And for each of us, it's a question of conscience. In the yoga world, I spent many years in the tradition of a teacher by the name of Swami Kripalu. He took the renunciate route. He practiced silence for 19 years. He did 10 hours a day of meditation. And through his experience and through the awakening of his consciousness, he talked about the fruit of his insight as the realization of Sanatana Dharma. And the word Sanatana Dharma translates, a couple of translations for it. One is eternal truth. It's the recognition of the truth that we all experience. And that truth is transcendent of race, it's transcendent of culture, it's transcendent of sex, it's transcendent of sexual orientation. It's the primal experience of awakened heart and mind. So whether your path takes you through the realm of relationships or it takes you through a deeply introverted path, it leads to that same ultimate realization that we are all members of one family. So I fell out of touch with my friend Gil from high school. And a few years ago, we'd send emails, you know, back and forth from time to time, but then we really fell apart. And a few years ago, he sent me a bunch of emails, and we had a great email exchange, and then we kind of fell off again. And then he urgently wanted to talk by phone. I remember us heading off to a long retreat, and we didn't reconnect. And I found out later that Gil had died, that he had cancer at quite a young age, and found that he had struggled a bit in his life and had joy in his life as well. And I can sort of feel the sense of regret of missing that opportunity to connect with a good old friend. And so I Googled for him to find any information about him. You know, Googled for his obituary, and I couldn't find anything. It was such a reminder of impermanence, how for myself, my obituary will disappear into the digital graveyard. So I'd like to close with a short meditation and a short reading from Maya Angelou about this path. Just thinking of your path, your inner world, and this shared world, this society we live in, this planet we inhabit together. We, unaccustomed to courage, exiles from delight, live coiled in shells of loneliness, until love leaves its high holy temple and comes into our sight to liberate us into life. Love arrives, and in its train come ecstasies, old memories of pleasure, ancient histories of pain. Yet if we are bold, love strikes away the chains of fear from our souls. We are weaned from our timidity. In the flush of love's light, we dare be brave. And suddenly we see that love costs all we are and will ever be. Yet it is only love which sets us free. In your own time, gently deepening the breath. And when you're ready, you can let your eyes open.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.